Citizen Kane. In the 1700s, a British gentleman had to buy a license for the privilege of carrying a walking stick, and he had to abide by a series of strict rules in order to get the license. He had to agree not to gesture with or wave the walking stick in the air, hang it from his clothing, or tuck it under his arm. Very few gentlemen disregarded these rules, and there was never a Kane mutiny. Don't be such a chicken. In the 1300s, the Black Death was treated with live pullets. What? The fuck? The bird's tail feathers were plucked, and the bird was placed on the patient's infected sores. When the bird became infected and died, it was replaced with another. The live pullet treatment was believed to draw the poisons from the patient, but it didn't work. The only plus side of this treatment was that it was more enjoyable to spend time with someone who had the plague if they had a chicken on their head. Not if the chicken has the plague to... Aww. Myth. If you touch a baby bird, its mother won't recognize its scent and will abandon it. False. Animals with a keen sense of smell, like dogs, might react negatively to the smell of another animal on their pup, but they wouldn't abandon them. Birds, however, have some of the poorest olfactory senses in the animal kingdom. Basically, you could rub dog poop on the chick and its mom wouldn't know the fowl from the fowl. God, that's so sad. Here I come to save the day. What? Mighty Mouse. The American Family Association. What? Whoa. Okay. The American Family Association, a watchdog group from Tupelo, Mississippi, filed a complaint with CBS about an episode of Mighty Mouse, the New Adventure cartoon that aired on April 23rd, 1988. The complaint stated that the heroic rodent was seen snorting cocaine. The Reverend Wildman, on behalf of the AFA, described the questionable scene as follows. Mighty Mouse is down in the dumps. He reaches into his cape, pulls out a substance, and sniffs it through his nostrils, and from that point on in the cartoon, he is his normal self. CBS producer Ralph Bakshi explained that in The Little Tramp, Mighty Mouse was sad because he was in love with Polly Pine Blossom, but she didn't feel the same way. Polly sold him a broken and withered flower that turned to dust when he took it, and later in the episode, he inhaled the flower pieces. The case never went to court, and Mighty Mouse was never called to the stand. One thing Reverend Wildman never asked was what type of flower it was. I bet it was an opium poppy, because everyone knows mice are hopheads. Oh, this book is so dumb. Let's see. Michelangelo is credited with having created the only shopping list known to have become a work of art. His cook was illiterate, so the Renaissance master drew pictures of wine, fruit, bread, and spaghetti. Get the job done. Quicker than a grindstone. At the beginning of the Victorian era in Great Britain, Thomas Saverland approached Carolyn Newton in a jocular fashion and attempted to kiss her. She rejected his advances and then chewed him out. Well, actually, she just chewed off a piece of his nose. Saverland took Newton, the nose gnasher, oh my God, to court in 1837, but she was acquitted. The judge rules when a man kisses a woman against her will, she is fully entitled to bite his nose if she so chooses. I wonder if the judge polled the jury and counted eyes and nose. Oh my God. Chinese checkers did not originate in China, and the game doesn't use checkers. Created in England, popular in the United States and Japan long before China ever heard of it. Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer due. 2001, A Space Odyssey, the 68 science fiction film by Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick. In one scene, the HAL 9000 talking supercomputer contacts NASA to explain a malfunction with the sentence, "Houston, we've got a problem." On April 13th, 1970, while the crew of the ill-fated Apollo 13 played Thus Spake Zarathustra, the theme music from The Space Odyssey, an oxygen tank in the service module exploded. Commander Jim Lovell contacted Mission Control to explain the malfunction with the sentence, "Houston, we have a problem." The Retriever of Zenda. In Pike County, Pennsylvania, in the summer of 1924, a neighbor of Governor and Mrs. Gifford Pinchot was accused of killing Mrs. Pinchot's cat. The governor was enraged and immediately had the crazed cat killer arrested, personally presiding over the murderer's hearing and then holding the case over for trial. The accused was allowed no legal counsel, and serving as judge and jury, Pinchot sentenced him to life imprisonment. The governor reportedly treated the defendant like a dog, which in this case was fitting because the accused was a dog, a Labrador retriever named Pep. The dog was collared and taken to the state penitentiary in Philadelphia, where the warden, after being hounded by the governor to incarcerate the animal, finally gave Pep a prison ID number, Charlie 2559. Since Pep was a male dog, he never became anybody's bitch, and after serving 6 years in his cell, he died of old age in 1930. Are you fucking kidding? A unique groundbreaking experiment. In 1958, the Boeing B-47E Stratojet accidentally released a nuclear bomb that landed in a Mars Bluff, South Carolina family's vegetable garden, creating a 35-foot deep crater. That's tough to hide. The bomb exploded, destroying the house of Walter Gregg and several other homes and injuring 6 people. Fortunately, the explosion was only the detonating device, which is TNT, and didn't trigger the nuclear material. Needless to say, the tomatoes were ruined, and the Air Force apologized. Oh my god. Knocking over a stone wall. During the Battle of Chancellorsville on the night of May 2, 1863, Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson took a small group of men to uncover a possible weakness in the Union's position. When he returned, he wasn't greeted by a hail of cheers, but by a hail of bullets from a North Carolina regiment that thought he and his men were Yankee cavalrymen. Although his wounds didn't seem life-threatening at first, he contracted pneumonia after having his left arm amputated and died 8 days later. So remind me what's so friendly about friendly fire? Yeah, no shit. The Pride of Idaho. When a new territory in the Pikes Peak mining area, with Denver at its center, needed a name, Dr. George M. Willing, an eccentric lobbyist, suggested the name Idaho. Willing claimed the name was an Indian word meaning gem of the mountains. But shortly before Congress agreed on the name, it was discovered that Dr. Willing had invented the word Idaho and the territory became Colorado instead. However, 2 years later, when another mining territory in the Pacific needed a name, some remembered Idaho but forgot that it had been a hoax. So on March 4, 1863, the territory of Idaho was established. When statehood was achieved in 1890, the name had stuck. Therefore, the United States has a state based on a phony Indian name, making it the greatest practical joke of all time. Yeah. It's not bad. The Douglas fir tree isn't a fir tree, it's a pine tree. Don't that figure. Indians with no reservations. Naming Idaho might have been the greatest practical joke of all time, unless you look at the etymology of the name Des Moines. In June 1673, Father Jacques Marquette gathered with representatives of the Peoria Indian tribe near the mouth of what is now the Des Moines River. He asked the Peoria the name of the rival tribe that lived further along the banks and was told they were called the Moingoana, Moin being derived from this word. But 330 years later, researcher Michael McCaffrey of Indiana University, while researching the now extinct Miami, Illinois language, basing his conclusion on another linguist, discovered that the literal translation of the word is, in polite term, the excrement faces. Okay, that's fucking good. Fortune cookies, along with the check, are traditional. Oh, yeah, fortune cookies were born in San Francisco, not in China. Yes. There's a lovely factory down by the wharf. The reflecting pool. A party was thrown on August 1st, 18... Wow. Era, words, dyslexic, holy shit. The reflecting pool. A party was thrown on August 1st, 1985 for lifeguards of the New Orleans Recreation Department to celebrate their first season in which no one became a victim of drowning. Of the 200 partygoers, more than half were lifeguards, and four additional lifeguards were stationed on duty. When the party concluded, there were one guest less. 31-year-old Jerome Moody was found dead on the bottom of the pool. File this one in the drawer marked irony. How do you not notice a dude at the bottom of the pool? The 18th Amendment to the Constitution, along with the Volstead Act, which defined, intoxicating liquors, was ratified on January 16th, 1919, but not everyone wanted to jump off the wagon. Rhode Island never ratified the 18th Amendment nor accepted the conditions of prohibition. No shit. Go Providence. A shot at legal history. Clement L. I'm not even going to try. Was a highly controversial Ohio politician who provoked much hostility by being a leader of the Copperhead faction of anti-war pro-Confederate Democrats during the American Civil War. Convicted as a traitor, his sentence of 2 years in prison was changed by President Lincoln to exile to the Confederacy. After the war, he moved back to Ohio and became a prominent lawyer who was known for his impassioned speeches. But during his final case, he really shot off his mouth. On the night before the trial, he was showing his colleagues that his client, Thomas McGahan, was innocent of murder and that the victim, Tom Myers, had actually shot himself. To demonstrate his theory, he shoved a pistol in his pocket, withdrew it, cocked the hammer, and pronounced, "There, that's the way Myers held it," and pulled the trigger. The bullet entered his body just the way it entered Myers, and the result was just as deadly. "My God, I've shot myself," he cried. Shortly after this occurrence, and based on his deadly demonstration, his client was acquitted of all charges and released from custody. The judge rested the case, and the lawyer rested in peace. Oh, Jesus. A highly charged article. Alfred Nobel became a millionaire several times over and changed the face of mining, construction, and warfare as the inventor of dynamite. On April 12, 1888, his brother Ludwig died of heart trouble, and a leading French newspaper inadvertently ran an obituary of Alfred Nobel. "The merchant of death is dead," the article read. "Dr. Alfred Nobel, who became rich by finding ways to kill more people faster than ever before, died yesterday." Nobel was upset to find out not only that he had died, but that when his time is up, he would be remembered only as one who profited from death and destruction. To make sure he was remembered fondly, Nobel bequeathed the bulk of his estate, $4,223,500 in 1896, to establish the Nobel Prize, awarded to those influential in advancing the causes of peace, literature, and the sciences. So in essence, Nobel had to die before he realized what his life was really about. Can we say Stanford University and Rockefeller Center? Starved for attention. Sarah Jacobs, a Welsh teenager, became a celebrity in the 1870s for being able to go without eating for months at a time. Her parents put the young girl on exhibit, charged admission, and claimed their daughter had gone more than 2 years without a single piece of food. Spectators were intrigued by the emaciated girl, but Welsh officials were concerned the exhibit was a fraud and the young girl was in danger of starvation at the hands of her greedy parents. They placed her under the care of a professional nurse whose job it was to verify whether Sarah consumed anything, thereby proving one way or another if her parents were telling the truth. After 9 days, officials were certain the parents had been lying, and they were arrested and sent to prison for fraud. How did they know that the claims were false? Because at the end of the 9th day, Sarah, who wasn't given any food during the observation, died of starvation. That'll show her parents. Oh my God. Man cannot live by bread alone. In 1997, in suburban Bucks County, Pennsylvania, an alarming number of assaults were reported in supermarkets, grocery stores, and bakeries. The assaults weren't on women, they were on baked goods. Thanks to security cameras, the identity of the cookie crumbler was finally unwrapped. Dear Lord. It was a 37-year-old advertising executive, Samuel Feldman. Feldman never squeezed the Charmin, but he did squeeze $800 worth of cookies, 3,087 loaves of bread, 227 bags of dinner rolls, 175 bags of bagels, and more, for a total of $7,000 in baked items. Trying. Okay. Fuck me running. Oh. Okay. Jesus Christ. Holy crap on a cracker. Feldman didn't gently caress the croissants or pet the pumpernickel. He squished. That is so stupid. He squished everything so hard it wasn't fit to sell and had to be discarded. At his trial in the year 2000, Sharon Feldman, his wife, came to his defense by pleading freshness is important to Samuel. She tried to convince the jury her bread-abusing husband was only concerned his family had the freshest baked goods available. She really buttered up the jury, and they almost rolled in his favor, but the judge wasn't going to let the loafer off. He ruled that Feldman was guilty, and his behavior was not just odd, it was criminal. I wonder if he was sentenced to just bread and water. Oh my God. Holy crap. Okay. Is it reprocracy? What the fuck is that supposed to mean? If the United States is a democracy, then the founding fathers must have believed a democratic country was the way to go. It's not a democracy, it's a republic. But, oh, first of all, the United States is a democracy, it's a republic. Remember, and to the republic for which it stands, the men who framed the Constitution disagreed on a lot of things, but on one point they stood united, that a democracy was the worst possible form of government. The idea that our country is built on majority rules is far from the truth. The founding fathers knew that a democracy would quickly lead to mob rule. That's why our system of government is set up the way it is. We elect the senators and congresspeople to represent us. We vote for them. Blah, yeah, yeah. That's what a republic means. because the common man thinks not at all. Can't keep a good man down. Did you ever wonder where Edgar Allan Poe got his inspiration when writing ghoulish tales of people buried alive like the premature burial? Well, it wasn't all fiction. In the days before modern medicine and proper embalming techniques, in fact, several ingenious inventors patented for the nearly departed grave signals, or what I like to call dead ringers. The first such patent from 1843 was a spring-loaded coffin lid, good only for before one is buried, obviously. In 1868, Newark, New Jersey, inventor Franz Vester patented a post-burial contraption that consisted of a tube directly over the face that, and I quote, extends from the coffin up through and over the surface of the grave, said tube containing a ladder and cord, one end of said cord being placed in the hand of the person in the coffin, the other end of said cord being attached to a bell on top of the square tube, so that should the person be interred ere life is extinct, he can, on recovery to consciousness, ascend from the grave by the ladder, or, if not able to ascend by said ladder, ring the bell, thereby giving an alarm, and thus saving himself. And just in case you're wondering, Saved by the Bell did not originate from these grave signals. It originated from the ringing of the bell of the boxing match. Let's see. In case of emergency, break glass. The award for weirdest deceased detector goes to a device patented in 1899 by M.C.H. Nicole of France. His creation utilized a hammer that, activated by any movement of the corpse, would swing down and break a glass window situated over the head of the departed. This would allow air to enter the coffin, and the noise of the breaking glass would serve as an alarm, used only before burial. I have a grave concern about this invention. If anyone did awaken from a coma and try to sit up, his or her head would smash through the glass window, followed shortly by a solid clobbering of the hammer. But what better place to be for such an occurrence than in a coffin and already dressed up? Nothing up my sleeve, nothing in my head. In 1977, a woman calling herself a psychic escapologist announced she was going to drive a car 60 miles per hour over the course of 1 mile while wearing a blindfold. Her only source of direction, she boasted, was tapping into the minds of people in the crowd who would communicate to her which way to turn. No sooner had I started than I felt myself reading the mind of someone in the crowd, she said. This thought transferee began giving me explicit instructions, but just as the alarm bell told me I had reached 50, they stopped beaming. Although her GPS, her group paranormal supervision, was out of whack, she felt compelled to corner the car, which she did, right into the corner of a barn. The psychic was knocked unconscious and was taken to the hospital to recover from her extensive injuries. She assured her fans she would soon complete the rest of her planned routine, escaping from a large, heavy-duty plastic bag in only 20 minutes. The only thing she couldn't escape was her own stupidity. Digging for research. Of all the topics of a scientific study, why did researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison pick rhinotelexomania? The answer was right in front of their noses. It's the scientific term for what lay people call nose picking or snotus diggeris outis. Oh, that's so fucking wrong. In 1990, the university mailed out questionnaires to 1,200 people trying to dig up the answers to such penetrating questions as what finger do you use when picking your nose? And oh my God, and after picking your nose, how often do you find yourself looking at what you've removed? And of course, the question on everybody's mind, do you, oh my God, okay. Apparently, we're not going to get the answers to this because I don't imagine they got too many answers. A very queer relationship. The truth may never come out of the closet on this one, but then again, there might not have been much of a closet to come out of. It's the story of two men, James Buchanan and William Rufus Devane King. One became the 15th president of the United States, the other vice president under Franklin Pierce. But when they first met each other while serving as members of Congress, they became immediately inseparable, and it had been rumored for years that they were a couple. It was never proven, Buchanan, however, the only bachelor ever elected president. What is known is that Buchanan and King were commonly referred to as other members of Congress as Mr. Buchanan and his wife, and Miss Nancy and Aunt Fancy. So when Buchanan was passing legislation in Congress and King said, I've got your back, it might have meant something completely different. Oh, see, that's just fucked up. East is East and West is West. In studying the history of America's Western expansion, you'll inevitably hear or read Horace Greeley's immortal line, Go West, young man. As you've probably guessed by now, he never said this particular line. He did, however, write it. You see, John Babson Soule first wrote this advice in an article in Indiana's Terre Haute Express in 1851, and Horace Greeley reprinted the article in his New York Tribune. In Greeley's reprint, he pointed out that Soule was the original author of the article and the quote, but that didn't stop the general public from giving him the credit, and now the quote and the man who reprinted it are forever synonymous.